All right. So, who are you?
Well, my name's Bill Buxton, and I am working Microsoft Research, and I've been at Microsoft for about 2 years coming up this December, so I'm fairly new still.
Okay. And so what do you work on? I hear that you're into design, but, like, what do you do?
Well, it's a by necessity. My background was actually in music, so there's always sort of been this creative thing. That's what I did my degree in. I spent 20 years as a professional composer and performer. But I started very early. Actually, I did my first film soundtrack 100% digitally, composed and performed in 1971. I repeat, 1971. And by the way, that system had a mouse on it. It had a chord keyboard, two-handed input, color graphics display, and real-time sound synthesis.
My goodness.
And so you're thinking, well, just a sec, that sounds like a Macintosh or something like that, but this is almost 15 years before the Mac came out. This is 2 years before Xerox PARC had a mouse. And so this is a system that was developed at the National Research Council of Canada. I was an undergraduate music student at the time. And by the way, it's exactly the same system that was used to make one of the world's first digital animation packages. And so the first film ever, computer-generated film ever nominated for an Academy Award was being made at precisely the same time during the days on the same computer that I'd come in at nights to do my music.
Interesting.
So I had that was the first time I'd seen a computer. I knew nothing about it, and they seemed easy and they seemed wonderful. And that set my career. And then I went back to the last year, my fourth year of music, and I decided I'll take a computer course because computers are easy. I took that. And so I had a course in Burroughs Extended Algol. And this had punched cards and that. And there was no relationship between computing as it existed then, in 1972, 73, after that first experience. And in fact, that continued right up into the 80s. My first experience wasn't there. So I became a designer of sorts of technology, not because I had any great imagination, but out of survival, simply to recapture my very first experience that wasn't available to me anymore once that system disappeared.
Interesting.
And to just recreate. But I was designing to something I knew was possible because in some sense I'd already experienced it. But that didn't mean there weren't a lot of challenges.
Sure.
And so I always had this view, there's normal specification, there's military specification, and then there's rock and roll spec. And so this notion, music was a really good training ground because computers weren't designed to be musical instruments to play on stage, to work in real time, to take multi-handed input in bad lighting, to load up in the back of trucks and haul around like you would your guitar amplifiers and so on and so forth. And actually, so I was designing hardware as well as software for not just touch-sensitive devices and different types of keyboards and other transducers, but also digital signal processors to do the sound synthesis. And so I was doing hardware and software, obviously with a great group of people working with me.
Sure.
But at a certain point, someone said, well, this has relevance outside of music. And I was doing this around the University of Toronto at the time, and actually my funding agency said, if you keep talking about music, we're going to cut your funding off. So being a pragmatist,
sure,
this is the other part of being a designer, and I just applied my creative skills to saying, look, this isn't a drum. This is a multi-touch sensitive programmable controller for real-time control, for controlling real-time processes. And, of course, that's what a drum is. A piano keyboard is simply a switch array that gives you random access to a discrete set of ordered events. So I could describe things in whatever language they wanted, talk about the science behind it. And so I'm actually as much a researcher, or perhaps more a researcher than I am now as a designer. I started as a musician. So I started, it turned out that the stuff that we were doing, because we were highly driven by an application, actually turned out to let us design and invent things that hadn't existed before in the mainstream computer world. And I think it's because we didn't know they were hard. but we were also driven by real needs and real users and so on. So very, very early on, the value of user-centered design and going really deep in applications to come up with innovative solutions, the value of that became clear.
Sure.
And so once I was too uneducated to be stupid.
Excellent.
And so I didn't know that you weren't supposed to be able to do this stuff. And again, I was very fortunate in where I was working and who I was working with. Mm. All of those people, none of us knew that what we were doing at the time was quite as interesting as it was. So it wasn't about ego. We were just having a lot of fun.
So now, I mean, for, you know, stepping into the so more into the modern day, for the modern day designers, I mean, they are sort of limited by a tool set, aren't they? I mean, if you think about the web and what they have to work with as far as fixed display, and they're not given a blank canvas, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, so this comes back to the initial question, so what do I do, and sort of at Microsoft, both within research and outside. So there's this really interesting thing that happened. Sort of from the period when the graphic user interface became just standard, mm-hmm. you know, the mouse, keyboard, the GUI, and that sort of stuff. Up until that point, people in user interface design largely were building hardware as well as software because things weren't standardized. You know, what was the interface? And from starting with the Macintosh in, let's say, 84, but certainly after Windows 95, the whole field basically grew into just how do I tweak and improve the aesthetics or the interaction within the confines of the GUI. Mm. And the notion of just sort of saying, let's toss that all out and start from scratch. Let's do to the GUI what the GUI did to DOS. Let's do to Windows what Windows did to DOS, right? Mm-hmm. Don't ignore your heritage, but, you know, let's keep it going. And in some sense, what's so fascinating right now is that all of those skills that I got in the early days are now relevant again. So if we look at things like, let's say, surface computing,
sure.
Well, that is in some ways. It doesn't eliminate the keyboard and the desktop, because those still have value for certain things, but they're terrible for certain other things. Mm-hmm. And like vice versa, everything's best for something and worse for something else. Look at ubiquitous computing, look at mobile, look at things like entertainment, whether it's a Zune or other things around that, but this whole population of devices. Let's look at the really big displays that are embedded in the environments and how they relate to the things that are on my wrist and so on. And we realize that now the opportunities to say the solution is some combination of hardware and software, but it's not just a device like this, which is my this is the HTC Touch, which is my favorite mobile phone, but it's this as a member of a society that populates the larger ecosystem of technology. So I don't just care about this as by itself, but how I can relate to your phone, to this, how it relates to the electronic whiteboard. So send this whiteboard behind me if it's live. In 4 years it will be. In 4 to 5 years, it'll be cheaper to have a 100 dot per inch display per square foot than that whiteboard.
Huh.
Like that, there's going to be this crossover. And then how does this let me throw things up on it, grab things back? Can I use this touch surface to control that display in the same way the touchpad on my laptop controls its display?
Hmm.
Right? Can you and I work on it together? Can I throw things up by a gesture? Can I pull things back? How do they work together when they are together and have the social conventions that they move apart? So they still work standalone when it's on its own. And all of those things become, it's actually more exciting now than it was in the 70s and 80s when I started.
Hmm.
And now the question is the same, can we work, that's what's so great about being at Microsoft, is because I can think of no other place where in all of the different sectors that would be involved in what I just described, you know, mm-hmm. big things, small things, mobile things, wireless, the software, the systems, the security, the touch sensors, the different user interface paradigms, all these things. There's no other company that's a player in every one of those components.
Sure.
And if you're going to have a society, then you better have a very rich society. You don't, there's people who play well in any one of the components, but mm-hmm. nobody plays in all of them except us. And so some of it's pretty chaotic still, because we're thinking about these things as islands and not as in this society of appliances that populate the same space as the society of people. But how do we start to make that work? And if you understand that, it sort of says, and partially why I haven't answered your question yet, and it's because I'm like a ping pong ball going back and forth. On the one hand, I'm a propeller head who loves to get down, and so developing new types of displays, new types of messaging. I'm really interested in pen-based input and ink, and I'm working on specific projects around those things at the detailed device level. Mm-hmm. But at the other hand, there's no point in having a really good point solution here, there, and there. Mm-hmm. There's this larger part. So what's the bigger vision that ties them all together? What's the overarching vision? So I spend a lot of time thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And the other part is, what's the process we need to do to make this real? So I'm spending, I'd say, half of my time talking to the engineering community, the design community, the business community, and also from the senior executive to the most recent recruit straight out of an undergraduate program, mm-hmm. to try and understand where the problems are and how, as a company, mm-hmm. do we actually make this happen? How can we do it faster? There's some literature that says that design and innovation and process mm-hmm. might have as much as a tenfold improvement in return on investment than in product. Think about desktop computers. Apple has done a really good job in styling. Take the iMac.
Sure.
But at that time, Dell, who spent almost nothing on innovation in the product itself, their innovation and design went into their process of how do they manufacture, how do they distribute, how do they service. And they just took over for a good chunk of time. Mm-hmm. And there's a good example where it's the process that actually brought success, not the specific product. It's all of this other stuff. Now, of course, if you push that further, the way you then would go after Dell would be to say, I'm going to match or exceed their process, but I'm going to invest in a better product as well, like something that's really innovative. And in some ways, that's how what Apple did to Dell in, not so much in the computer space, but in the MP3 player, where Dell actually was also a player. Hmm. Right? And Apple innovated in their business model as well as the actual design of the product itself.
Absolutely.
And the larger ecosystem. So within Microsoft, I was spending a bunch of time looking at how do we do design? How do we organize ourselves? How do business, technology, and design work together as an interwoven sort of like DNA I have this great idea, but I don't know how to make it. Oh, well, I have an idea how I can change the business model. Oh, well, here's how I can make it work. So that's too expensive. Okay, here's a new way to technology. Well, if I change the design this way, we change the business model that way, maybe we can make this other stuff work, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this whole challenge about that jamming back and forth, those three pillars of the thing. So that, can we make it? Can it be made? Can we make it affordable? How do we make money? What should it be like so it'll be so compelling it'll just people go nuts about it?
So let me ask you this, because it brings up a question. I mean, lost in that model, though, are, at least explicitly, are the people that actually experience and use these things that we create. So my question is, how do you know that you've created something that people are going to love?
Yeah. It's that's the perfect question, and in some sense, I take that as just a smack to remind me things I just take for granted, and they're so deeply rooted in my assumptions that I don't even bother saying them because I just take it for granted. You think back to, so I was speaking earlier about the music stuff. What made that work? Why were we able to do things that got the attention of people like Alan Kay and Xerox PARC and so on and so forth by this little music group in Toronto, and that led to like a 15 or 20 year association with Xerox for me. It was because we were completely focused on the end user. This whole notion of user-centered design and customer-centric design, that sort of stuff. The only way, you know, when you're designing a product, this is the problem. If you're in some kind of vacuum, you're making decisions, and you think I'm just at six of one or half a dozen of the other, mm-hmm. and so we'll just make this one. And you have no idea that that decision, because you've got no exposure to real users, that that has a huge impact along a dimension you never even anticipated. So unless you're always working with representative user communities or doing representative tasks in a representative context, mm-hmm. You might as well be buying a lottery ticket, because you might get rich, you might mm-hmm. have a home run, but mm-hmm. I sure wouldn't bet my 401k on it. It just takes for granted these three, the trumpet that I'm sort of saying when I'm saying design, sure. business, and that, and technology, that's like building those are the same thing you'd have trumpet to.
Interesting. Wow, talk about user experience. We'll keep on going. There we go.
That's good.
Cool. See, that's not good user experience.
Yeah, gesture reduction. So
that's perfect, though. All right.
But what's fascinating is that it's like an architect would never build a building without knowing who was going to live in it and what they were going to do. Because they might build a chemistry lab when, in fact, it's a hospital that was required or a prison.
So basically what you're saying is those three elements could be considered like satellites orbiting the core, which is obviously the user.
Yeah. The sun, they're the satellites, and they're tightly interwoven, but the sun is the market, it's the user. And it's an interesting notion in terms of how you do that, how you even look at that. And that's why I think it's so fascinating, a company like Microsoft, is that, you know, what's the difference between a market and users? Because there's you can't know all your users. And how do you get to know your market and the representative users that make it up? And those are all really interesting challenges.
They really are.
And because, you know, in my last company, you know, which was in 3D graphics, we were very specific into, say, not industrial design, but for the industrial design, software for industrial design. It was primarily people designing automobiles. And so you can actually know your users at that point, because it's on a much smaller thing. The notion that there's like a billion people using a Microsoft product every day is guess what, you can't know them all. So that's so designing that process, that's another process you have to design in
certainly
the whole thing. And so, but those same challenges also mean that's like the nirvana, because it's like, what if you get it right? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the potential impact if you actually do great design that's really has huge value on every currency of value you want, right? It's maybe ecologically really good, it's intellectually really good, it's entertainment, it's a good business proposition, and all of those things, you know, those are all open for us.
So let me ask you that, because that generates another good question, and what is a good design? I mean, it's just very interesting to me that, because a lot of people will look at a design and they may not like it, right? Or how do you know that you've made a good design? Because of the market research that you've done? Or isn't there some other... For example, it seems to me that like when Apple starts throwing out these devices, they're getting something right consistently, which is interesting. Now, perhaps it's because they have a smaller market, or... I mean, what's going on there? So that's my question. How do you know that you've created a good design?
Look at the balance sheet. that's one way, not the only way, but I'll give you a better answer. First, I'd dispute one thing you said, that Apple throws out things consistently. I'd argue the only way that Apple has succeeded is because they repeatedly have colossal failures. Hmm. And if you're not failing repeatedly and regularly, you're not pushing hard enough.
Interesting.
So let me remind you about gems like the G4 Cube, the most beautiful computer ever made, probably, and a disaster in the marketplace. Let me remind you about Next.
Sure.
Let me remind you of the mouse that was on the first iMac. Since I'm Canadian, it had the, we call it the hockey puck mouse, because it was circular, and so when you gripped it, you had no idea which was up or down. So you'd move your hand this way, and the cursor would go that way because you had it, you didn't have it oriented correctly.
Interesting.
So, by the way, this isn't criticism of Apple. This is actually, I'm a competitive athlete, and I respect good competition. And actually, good competition out there helps us, makes it easier to bring change within Microsoft, too. So the fact is, here we've got, it's not consistent. You've got to push. But what makes great design is, the first thing is you have to understand what it is you're designing. So it's an interesting change in language, where it used to be user interface design, and then it was called interaction design, and now we call my field, let's call it experience design, or user experience design. And there's a reason for that. And it's been a change to sort of saying, is this what you design? A phone? Or a tin can? Or a pair of glasses? And the answer is no. In all cases, the answer is no. The thing that you sell is a pair of glasses. I mean, that's what I pay money for. That's the thing that in the transaction where I give you cash, you give me glasses. I give you cash, I get this thing. I might give you a credit card. But the thing is this, that it's not the thing that's in the box. It's not the software, but rather it's the experience that it engenders. It's the experience that enables. That is the actual tangible output of design. One of my favorite examples I use to explain that is when you buy a mountain bike, you're not buying the bicycle. You're buying the ability to scare the hell out of yourself, going down a hill with adrenaline pumping, going through water, bouncing over rocks with a reasonable chance you're not going to kill yourself and actually come off with a huge smile on your face.
Okay.
And the whole design thing of that ecosystem says that if you're going on downhill as opposed to single track, that here's the padding you can wear so you're not going to hurt yourself if you do fall, so that you can actually start to find out where your limits are and go closer to them, all that sort of stuff. There's this whole thing around it. It's about the clothing. It's about the style. It's about the lifestyle. It's about being healthy. It's about not smoking. It's about being out in the countryside. That's what you're selling, that whole package. And the question is, how do you encapsulate that? And so the bike is something that just provokes that experience or enables it or affords that experience. And I'd say the glasses help me establish some kind of image. Like, these are sort of weird glasses because they're sort of a little bit self-conscious with this side thing that does absolutely no purpose at all. But but I like them. They're distinctive and they have some character and they feel good.
And now, are those side things they actually lenses?
No, they do nothing. They're completely useless except they're kind of funky and they're just because they're a way of expressing oneself at the same time letting me see. So it's self-expression coupled with vision. And my mobile has all these other things with that. If you understand it's the experience you're designing, then if you get that experience and you can measure it in terms of what are the attributes, to a large extent, if people have a smile on their face and they're really happy either because they enjoyed using it or because it did what it surpassed their expectations in it, and they continue, then you probably were successful in the design of the product and the things. And then the other part, but the global design is, if you're not able to sustain a business around that, then it's not enough to have a great object that doesn't have great distribution or which is economically inviable because it's either... there's not enough margin to go to the next product and so on. So I think about design in a much larger context. I want it's got to be sustainable along all these different dimensions. But the first thing is, what does your face look like after you used? If you're swearing because you've had to call the help desk 5 times, I don't care. Once in the process of installing it, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'd say that even if once it's installed, it works the way it was advertised, that wasn't good design because you had a bad experience along the way.
Absolutely.
And so it's this total end-to-end. It's not the user interface of how does search work or how does find work, but from the moment I go. Here's a good example. Is that one could argue that with all this interest around search is irrelevant. Search isn't an application. Search is an interruption. Why do I need a search bar? Why wasn't there in the first place? And what was the context I was in when I jumped over to search to get there? If I start thinking about this larger experience of trying to work. Now, there's some places where I'm browsing and I really am just searching. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority, arguably, have nothing to do with search. It's just an interruption to go grab something I need to plug in to something else I was doing. Mm-hmm. What's that? How does that change the nature of how things could or perhaps should be designed to improve the experience so it's less disruptive, less likely to be sidetracked, and perhaps lets me get home to dinner on time for a change. Maybe that's what it's about.
Absolutely.
But I just those. But again, they're all about the people. Here's a one of my favorite examples of when people sort of say, "What are you thinking about when you talk about human-centered design and so on?" It's an interesting exercise you can do with people with a computer science background. Just sort of play dumb and sort of say, "Well, you know, I've heard this thing about primary and secondary memory, and I don't quite get it. Can you explain it to me?" And they'll sort of say, "Oh, yeah, your primary memory is like RAM. It's the stuff that's really fast, but it's a little bit expensive, so there's not so much of it. The secondary memory is like your hard drive, and that's where you store things. So it's slower to get to, but it's cheaper, so you have lots of it. And you just move stuff back and forth, and there's stuff like caching and so on, so you can optimize it. And there's a lot of interesting computer science stuff, but it's probably too hard if you don't even know what primary and secondary memory are." Mm-hmm. So I think I get it, but what if 70% of the data that's being passed between primary and secondary memory got lost or distorted on the way? Would that be a problem? And they'd look at you as if you're smoking crack and say, "Well, what a stupid, of course." Mm-hmm. "Well, do you mean that would be a stop ship bug?" "Well, yeah, of course. Nobody would ship something like that." And I says, "Well, isn't this primary memory and RAM secondary memory and the hard disk tertiary memory? And by the way, 50% of it does get distorted. So why are we shipping this stuff? And by the way, I am part of the system. And by the way, I can measure what goes back and forth to me. And in these different contexts and so on and so forth." Mm. "So why isn't that in the specification?" And so, I did a product for a digital cork board. And besides the working prototype, which was the, let's say, the living specification, the behavioral specification, the spec was any employee of General Motors, from the janitor to the president, had to be able to learn 80% of the functionality in 3 to 5 minutes with a 90% retention a week later, or it did not ship. That's a specification in human terms. Now, and then there's this other part in the behavioral part that sort of talks about what's the experience and what in the context. And so you have to flesh all these things out. So there's a whole other way to think about how we specify products, how we design them to those specifications. But what's clear is engineers are smart. They're really competent. They understand the spec. And by the way, if you have that specification, you will never see feature creep. You will see feature disappearance. And people integrate and say, "Hey, I can do these 3 steps in one. I can make it even simpler. Forget this 3 to 5 minutes. I'm going to do it in 1 to 2 minutes because I'm a really smart engineer and I'm a really smart designer and I'm going to show you that I can do even better than the spec." Mm. But you've got to set that bar. And it's a way of just recalibrating how we approach things and how we think about them. And in many ways, it actually makes all of us, whether you're the user experience person or the software engineer or the hardware engineer, it actually gives you even more freedom to show how clever you are and to express this excellence that you've cultivated over the years and what got you here in the first place. And I think that's the, for me, my biggest design project here would be, there's such an incredible talent pool, how can we actually make it so that there's even more opportunities for them to, for people to really demonstrate that that incredible competence that's here. And it's a funny thing, just the language we use to even specify a product can have a huge impact.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, let's be honest. We're not known as being the best design-minded company in the world. So.
But we are known as being a company that when... Paranoia is a wonderful thing. Right? We're known as a company that when somebody starts chewing at us and giving it to us really well, that we'll say, well, I'm not going to be third or fourth in this. I'm going to. Okay? That was a... Mm-hmm. I think in terms of ice hockey. Mm-hmm. You just checked me really, really well. I'm not going to get up and fight you. I'm going to get up. I'm going to train, and I'm going to come, and I'm going to cleanly come back and show you that I can play this game too, and I can play it really well, and I'm going to get to the point where I can play that game on par with anybody. So, Nintendo, Wii, iPhone, iPod, Google, companies like that, I love them. Because they let us focus and realize, you know what, we can do better, and we're up for the challenge. And we've done it in product after product, industry after industry. It's just we love to come from behind, and just look what the Xbox did.
Sure.
Right? And look what we did in the web, and so on. And I think that's I like that determination, and I like that discipline. But it's one of really hard work and doing what's necessary. And my sense is that it's hard work isn't enough and determination isn't enough, but they're essential. And if we couple that with a strong sense of design and innovation that's well directed, then it's pretty neat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what do you think about, you mentioned the web and the you know, wow, it happens again. This is a very interesting...
There you go.
Cool. Whoever designed this room, see, I think you should start working with them. Who designed this conference room? Clearly there's humans in here speaking.
Yeah, so they only have a motion detector and not audio detection. And if they just had a microphone, they just are only sensing one modality to determine whether there's anybody in here.
That's interesting. But you've been moving around a bit, and I move around a little when I talk, so I find that odd.
Yeah, we're in the wrong. You're in a better location than me. Because when I wave, it doesn't come on, but as soon as you move a bit, it comes back on.
Interesting. Okay, so I'll remember to keep moving over here. So with the advent of technologies like Silverlight, and then of course there was Flash and stuff like that. There's this big movement now to really center on the experiential, for the user experience on the web, right? So instead of clicking on just static links or whatever, you can have a really interesting experience with a web page.
Yeah.
So what are your feelings on the direction and the impact of design on the web?
So on the one hand, the folks over, I've been hanging out with the general manager and the PUM over on the expressions team and so on, making myself a nuisance, because I think that stuff's wonderful. I've been hooking them up with friends, people I know and respect out in the design world who are just doing some of the most creative content so that they can push us as hard as possible to make sure we get on the track. And I think that the tools are really, really interesting to develop. However, I have this other side of me that sort of says the web as we know it is boring and isn't relevant or won't be that relevant. Put it to you this way. This is a 10-year-old cliche of mine, so I've been saying this for actually over 10 years. That the diversity of web browsers tomorrow will match the diversity of ink browsers today. And if you sort of say, well, what's an ink browser? Mm-hmm. It's also called paper. So a really interesting diary exercise that I have students and colleagues do, even if it's just in their mind's eye, but it's better if you actually do it, is keep a diary for 24 hours of every encounter you have with paper, every single one, and make a note of that you saw it, and make and annotate it, like, how big is it, where was it, what was the content, how long is it going to be there for, and so on and so forth. And that means things from post-it notes to billboards to newspapers to books to signs on the wall that are around here, and to money, all these different things. And those are all different things, which are ink browsers. That's your browse ink on this medium called paper. It's a flexible mobile display that has, great power. Battery life is infinite. It's great. And then to say, my view would be is that if our thinking about the web and how we interact with stuff on the web doesn't encompass a richness of diversity comparable to what we're seeing with paper today, then we're thinking way too narrow. And we're already seeing some of this in something like with mobile phones. And you can sort of say, well, okay, well, you know, the first thing was we just started to put browsers on here that just brought up the same web content that was designed for a desktop PC, and that's how all the content. Well, I hate all of that for two reasons. One is that this isn't my desktop. What I want in here is very different, but I still want access to what might be out there on the web. But the second thing is that you ever notice in language, there's a similarity between channel surfing on television mm-hmm. and surfing the web. We use the same word, surfing.
Sure.
And both of them, and the reason is that both of them, up till now, have largely been following this paradigm where we'll offer you all kinds of interaction creative as long as it consists of choosing, selecting, push a button, follow a link. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't sound very creative to me. Blogging and some of these things and wikis are starting to change where I can not just select, but I can create and add to it. Some of the photo share and other things like that is starting to move that way. But it's still, the majority is still clicking through links and so on and so forth. And this asymmetric, I want an information culture that is as much that's symmetrical in terms of what I create versus what I send versus what I receive, where that isn't assuming that people are just sponges that absorb things that they've clicked on, and the creativity is just in what record they put in the CD. I want the saxophone. I don't want the record of the saxophone, and something I can play, and because there's so many diverse things that we want to do. Expecting any one form factor or any one model, like HTML browser or something like that, to be able to serve it is kind of ridiculous. So I love the plurality and the extended interactivity that things like Silverlight and Expression bring. But at the same time, you know, what do I do? Well, today I had a meeting over with the Surface team to sort of say, look, we got to have this thing so that if Silverlight and Expression can't build the types of applications really well that I want to see on Surface, then we're building a solution to last decade's problem. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? And how do we get the right people to drive that? And so on. Those are the types of questions that I think are really fascinating. If we do that effectively, you know, no one can stop us because we make Surface and we make the tools. And that's the ability to have within our collective family those conversations is why this extended family that is Microsoft is so such a rich and for me exciting place to work.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, I mean, in the company meetings, Steve Ballmer, you know, his message at the end was, "Don't be afraid to be bold."
Absolutely.
And I think that was the best message that I've heard from him in a long time.
No, be bold, and that these things are cultural. Mm-hmm. And in that same slide, I said there's these three intertwined things that I mentioned earlier, the business, technology, and design. And it's not enough to be bold in any one of them. The boldness comes in actually recognizing that you don't have all the answers, that if you I had this book I just put out this year, and I have a quote in it that I found that was a sign that was on Ronald Reagan's desk. And by the way, I'm probably the last person that most people would expect would be quoting something from Ronald Reagan. But it's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets credit for it. And if you can have really top-notch people in these three pillars working together, recognizing and respecting and really, loving mm-hmm. how the other ones fill in their own weaknesses in a complementary way, then I think we absolutely can start to make this stuff happen. And that in itself is a bold notion, but it's one that's easy to subscribe to.
Sure.
And so, absolutely right. I had one of my colleagues over in research, Kevin Schofield, sent me just a copy of PC World Magazine had this one page article to say what happened at the company meeting. I was sort of saying, hell, why don't we just invite the press to come to the meeting for pity's sakes, because it's leaking like a sieve. And he said, no, but Bill, you don't understand. Here's what's significant. It's in this one page summary of what was chosen to leak out that's important, because it says that if this, the points that were leaked to the press mm-hmm. were leaked from people within the company. Mm-hmm. And so if they leaked these points, it means that they got the point and they realized the point was important. Sure. So in the four sentences about Steve's speech, mm-hmm. they talked about the importance of being bold in the design.
They did.
In design, cool. Right? So that basically says the message got across. Mm-hmm. You and I weren't the only ones who caught that.
Sure.
And it went through to the rank and file to the point that they thought it was important enough to repeat to people they shouldn't have been talking to. But on the other hand, it lets us know that the message got across.
Absolutely.
So, we'll take those wins where we get them. And now the question is, what do we, on to the next step, how do we make it happen?
True. I mean, it brings up a good question, because unlike some of the companies that you'd mentioned earlier, we produce, for example, a general purpose operating system that is used by more human beings on this planet, at least that we know of. I mean, it could be on other planets as well. We don't know that. But the fact of the matter is, I've always been kind of really intrigued by the complexity of creating a coherent user design, even though I'm not a designer. But that, for a general purpose system that's used by a lot of people, so you're going to have restrictions. So your ability to be bold in Windows, for example, is going to be limited, because you are making a general purpose operating system that supports 40,000 different devices and billions of people. And everyone might have different things they use their window, their computer for, right? They might only ever use one application,
yeah.
Right? So how does that work?
Well, I'd say that I'm amazed at how well it's worked. So and how good of a job it's been done. But in the same breath, I'd also say our work is still really cut out for us to do it better. Right? There's no sitting resting on, Vista's great, let's get rid of Vista. I don't mean that at all in a negative thing. It's just like we got to keep every time there's a law, and here's the law. The law says that expectations grow faster than our ability to deliver on them. Which says that as a designer, as a company, as someone making products, if we do something, deliver a product, be it Vista or anything else, that exceeds expectations, does even better than anybody ever expected, Surface, whatever, that's not going to make people happy. It's just going to cause them to recalibrate their desires and their expectations. Mm-hmm. And the better we deliver, the steeper the curve that they're going to accelerate the expectations. And that's actually a law that we basically means our job is never done. you cannot. And if you want to step back and sort of say, step back from Microsoft and Dentsu, like, people talk about the good old days. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, there weren't good old days. That's a revisionist history. The quality of life and so on has continued, but we, no matter how much our standard of living and quality of life goes up, mm-hmm. in extent, compared to our parents and grandparents, we still think that there's problems. There's always room for improvement. And the thing that proves that is when there's nothing that accepts perfection. There's classics. I can go back to, like, my favorite classic is the Studebaker vaunted car. Everybody has these little things that are like classics of design, classics of music and things like that, but that doesn't mean that music history should have stopped with Beethoven or whoever your favorite musician is, or with the Beach Boys or whatever, or with any of that product. The progress continues, and it should be progressive as opposed to just change for change's sake. There are improvements. But the better you deliver, mm-hmm. the higher you set expectations for the next product. And therefore, the better you've got to be. You can't sit still.
True. Good point. So, and then as we wind down here, you've mentioned Surface a bunch of times, and I think, it's going to revolutionize. I mean, and it goes back to what you initially started talking about, the multi-touch devices that you had created in 71 to solve a real-world problem.
Yeah.
But now with the advent of Surface and multi-touch computing in general, you're going to change the way designers and engineers, but the way you're going to have to design something. So now you have a new problem. To figure out how to make somebody's PC as equally useful to them without using a keyboard, without using a mouse. I mean...
Yeah, so my sense would be, so I have this rule, everything's best for something, worse for something else. So I anticipate PCs with keyboards and mice and displays are going to be around for a long, 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 long time. Just as cinema didn't replace live theater and television didn't replace cinema, they just start to carve out different segments of this larger entertainment mix. Same thing. Keyboard and mouse, they're excellent if you're doing word processing and stuff like that.
Sure.
And I think they always will be, even if you had perfect speech recognition, because it's just a different way of working. They'll have their place. It's just the QWERTY keyboard isn't a good thing for music or for painting, so we'll have these, or for video. So we'll have this diversity of appliances, and each one specialized for certain things, and they'll interoperate and they'll be able to share data and move things around. That's the society of appliances, and that's how ubiquitous computing, what it means to me. The challenge is that how do we make these things work? Because if we do have these multiple devices and they have to coordinate, how do you keep things current as you update things that you don't have all this obsolescence, so you just fill landfill sites of things that were the hottest thing a year ago and are obsolete now because something got better? And in a way, the thing I don't want to waste even... there's no landfill site for human skills and efforts, but I don't want to waste and have a junk pile of things people have learned, spent tons of time in education, and just say, oh yeah, we had this really crummy design, you had to learn all this sort of stuff, all these conceptual models, you've invested all that training, and now we're just going to change those all together. So now you have to learn a whole other set of things, and everything's changed. I think this is human potential and human skill is something that we need to, it's one of the things we have to design, like how do we learn these things and what are the conceptual models, and so that in a way that are extensible, and that as we populate this space, there's as little waste as possible.
Interesting.
It's just like, think about it in the same way that, you know, you bought a big stereo, you bought all this vinyl, and all of a sudden they replace it with CDs, and then you buy all these videos, and then they're replaced with, you know, then you bought laser discs, right?
Yeah.
And then that lasted not for very long, and now out come the DVDs, and all of a sudden those are obviously, and you sort of saying, just a second here, I'm not going to get caught up in this. You know, you're making me replace my video, my movie collection, or my music collection. You know, one thing after another. I'm going to stop. You know, I just don't trust you anymore. And it's, but in fact, far more expensive than the physical things there that I'm having that are rendered obsolete are my skills. So there was a reason to learn how to drive a car, and you lost the skill of shoeing a horse, feeding a horse, and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. There was a sea change in technology, but since the 30s, if the car has had a continuity, so the people who could drive a car went along, there hasn't been a similar transition to a complete paradigm shift of how to conduct transportation, ground
Absolutely.
Transportation since then. And so my skills weren't wasted, so the success of models. Now, the GUI, I think its longevity from, let's say, the mid-70s when it started to be known within the research community, and certainly by 82 when the Xerox Star came out mm-hmm. through till now, that's one of the reasons why I think it's gotten so much traction, because even if you move from XP to Vista or to a Mac, even you recognize it. It's sort of like moving from a GM to a Ford, or maybe a little bit harder in some cases, like from a stick shift to an automatic. But even those are all manageable.
Sure.
Because it's way easier than moving. As someone who's learned how to ride horses late in life, the transition from car to horse is. It's a whole other deal. You don't want to do that all the time unless you're doing it for fun, or the value, the return on investment is huge, either in terms of enjoyment or productivity.
Outstanding.
And so with these new families of devices, it's not just about the design of the device, it's about the design of the ecosystem. And that's a really big challenge. And and that's why what we often forget is that we have one other thing that, for example, Apple doesn't have. We have research, and we have the world's best computer science department, without any question.
Mm-hmm.
The Microsoft Research is the best university research organization in the world. It's better than MIT. It's better than Stanford, in my humble opinion, and mm-hmm. that's why I came here instead of to Stanford or MIT or the University of Toronto, where I was.
Excellent.
Because we have this brain trust that works with those universities and mm-hmm. some of the smart people and our collected network of smart people mm-hmm. to help. We're in here not just for a good time, but for a long time. And mm-hmm. that long-term thinking that brings helps inform the types of longer, harder problems that product groups shouldn't have to. They've got their own set of really hard problems.
Exactly.
So you divide and conquer, and then we use that collective brain trust of development and research to really bring things together. And I just want to populate that a little bit more with more design to go with the product, to go with the research and the business.
Outstanding. Well, it's going to be, I'm looking forward to seeing. I mean, you've only had 2 years at it now, so it'll be interesting to see. We'll come back and check in on you over the years.
No, not that many years. I'm old. I don't have time to waste.
So
here's the best part. I don't think it's going to take tons of time. Mm-hmm. That's the best. I think the last company I was with was a 500-person company with about, in its very best year, $100 million revenue. Here we had a company with 80,000 employees.
Mm-hmm.
The change here has been easier to get traction and get things and things happening here than at a 500-person company. That's the magic of this place, and gets me up in the morning with ready to go.
Excellent. Well, good ideas always win.
Yeah.
And they stand a chance here.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I mean, look, we pulled off Channel 9.
Yeah.
So, and 4,000 people blog.
Work
at Microsoft. It's amazing with no real PR filtering.
Yeah.
So it's pretty interesting.
No, but it's the quick final thing. It's mm-hmm. a similar thing at Microsoft Research. You would expect it to be the secret place, but the interesting thing is that it's more open than any other place I've ever been. People talk about open source.
Mm-hmm.
This is really quick, but
sure.
It's a really important point.
Uh-huh.
People get on a case about open source, wanting to do the source code for this and that, and sort of say, well, just a sec, what would you rather have? Would you rather have the source code to Windows? God, what the hell are you going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
But do you really want to spend your time understanding that? Or would you rather have the open publication of the output of our entire research organization? Hmm. Which is, you know, don't tell me we're not open. Go to SIGGRAPH and realize that a ridiculous percentage of the papers come from Microsoft, out there in the open literature. Go to SIGCHI, go to any computer conference, and look at the openness and the just the quality and the quantity of research that's going out there that we're sharing with the community, at us, including our competitors.
Absolutely.
And the funding we put into those conferences. And tell me that this isn't the most open company in the world. And you know what? The one thing I fault the company is that we don't point that out strongly enough.
No.
And we don't come back strongly
enough. We just did.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Great to meet you.
My pleasure. And, I look forward to the next time.
All righty. Take care.
Bye.